I think that we don't agree that it's all free real estate. Just because you've got 64 gigabytes of RAM in your MacBook Pro M3 doesn't mean that applications should be consuming everything they can get their hands on. When you're shipping an application that has a million users, you're shipping an app with a million downloads, and you're shipping that app on a weekly cadence with updates, that creates terabytes and terabytes and ultimately petabytes of traffic over a year that you don't need.
Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. We're really excited to have Daniel and Lucas joining us today. So this dynamic duo are the co-creators of Tari, and also have a company called Crab Nebula, which does consulting for Tari and some new product work, which we'll be really excited to talk about today. I am super excited. I'm a huge fan of Tari. But before we dig in and start talking about that, would you each like to take a moment to tell our listeners a little bit more about yourselves?
Yeah, sure. I'm Lucas. I live in Brazil. I am 27 years old and feeling a little bit old because I keep meeting young superstars who are like 18 years old. That's impressive. And I started my career like 7 years ago as a full stack engineer, but when we started Tari, I started shifting to doing more like native stuff. And I co-founded Tari together with Daniel 5 years ago, I think. And that's pretty much it.
Hi, I'm Daniel. I'm the older half of the duo. From the US originally, I've spent a lot of years in Europe and currently living in Malta. I think, you know, I'm sure we'll get into these questions later, but when I met Lucas, I knew my career as a software engineer was basically over. he's shown me so many ways to do things better that I decided, you know, the best thing I can do is get out of his way, support him any way I can. And, 5 years later, here we are, still friends, and we've met each other's children. And, I think that the friendship that we have is probably the most important thing for me that I get out of open source. Anyway.
That's really awesome.
That's what makes this duo really dynamic. Like, I'm more like a coder, and Daniel is more like a speaker. So he managed that for me. This is actually my first time doing a podcast. So that's cool.
Cool. Well, we're glad to have you. Something Andrew and I have learned is that the division of labor is really important to figure out with a duo, and that marketing is really important. So having someone that can speak well is actually quite an important thing. Out of curiosity, how did y'all meet originally?
We met in the Quasar framework. I was working on this company here in Brazil, and I was basically doing some Angular work, and I did not really want to do that anymore. So I started investigating some alternatives, and I met Vue, which I wanted to use. So I started checking some frameworks, and I found this framework called Quasar. So I joined their Discord, and that's when I met Daniel. And it was on that Discord that Daniel made the challenge that started Tari with.
What was the challenge?
Yeah, I think Daniel can speak more about that one, but it was basically just to have an app that uses the system Webview.
It does have a bit of a backstory. So at Quasar, I'd sort of finished my two big tasks. And those were, you know, bringing up the testing framework and building an icon manufacturing tool. Because what Quasar did was provided a framework for anybody to build a SPA, an SSR, an Electron app. At that time, I think it was still Cordova. And I was looking to expand our reach because it was right around the time that Quasar was about to hit 1.0. And I discovered that Pure OS was about to have an app store. That's what they were planning back in 2019, I think. And I visited their Matrix Element chat room and said, hey, how does it look to put apps on your desktop app store? And they're like, sure, what's the stack? And I said, Electron. And like, I've never been laughed out of a chat room before, but they were very friendly. They said, go check this FSF thread that's 12 years long, this mailing list that has like trees of ungoogled Chromium all the way to missing SPDX headers. And once you've understood why we can't put Electron apps onto a Debian-based, well-governed operating system, come on back, right? And it was right around that time that a friend showed me the WebView library, which was basically just a C wrapper. Well, I mean, basically, there's a lot more going on under the hood, but it provided a method by which you could harness and interact with the system WebViews. And suddenly we thought, hey, we've got a solution here, and this is going to be easy. Famous last word.
Famous last words, indeed. Well, one thing I was going to say is I appreciate this challenge. So I work at Oxide. We do a lot of Rust-based stuff. We build a lot of our own tools. We also run our servers run Illumos, or a version of Illumos, which is a rather obscure operating system based off of Solaris back from the Sun days. And a lot of times when you want to use a tool on that, you have to build the tool yourself. So recently I was like, oh, I would love to like write this Dino script. And then one of the guys who's like helps maintain Illumos, who's on our team, he was like, kind of laughed. He's like, well, good luck. You know, you're going to have to do a lot of things. And like, one of the things you're going to do is build V8 and like do all these other things. It's like, and then I started going down the rabbit hole of like, what does it take to actually introduce a complex tool to a new system like this? And it can be non-trivial for sure. So the less native dependencies you have, actually, for a lot of systems, the better.
Okay, so now we've set the stage a little bit. Let's explain what Tori is to those who don't actually know. So what is Tori, and why would you use it over some of the existing alternatives like Electron, you said?
Well, we've seen a lot of definitions. I think it kind of depends on your use case, because we try to be as agnostic as possible, but we are basically just a framework for app development. Most of our users are using a web application to transform that to a native app, but we also have ways to use OpenGL and that kind of stuff. And we try to provide all the tools they need to bootstrap, develop, and ship an application.
So I work on an Electron application at work. And one of the big things that like people complain about with Electron is, oh, you sent me a whole browser along with it. And as you said, you guys use WebViews. So are there like advantages and disadvantages to doing that? Because like what I can think of, like, every time I've mentioned Tori to somebody, they're like, oh, that's interesting. So I have to support like multiple browsers and I have to test in multiple environments. So is that one of the disadvantages that comes with this?
Yeah, that's one of the disadvantages. But if you are already building a web application, you already have to test all those browsers. So it's not really that huge deal for most users. And that's also why the app is smaller and a little bit faster as well. But one of the major advantages we see is that it's safer to patch security vulnerabilities because it's handled by the operating system instead of you having to bundle your application again because Chromium has some issue. You have something to add to that?
Sure. I mean, I think at the beginning, we compared ourselves to Electron, and I'm guilty of getting into shouting matches on Twitter with Marshall of Sound. Love you, bro. Sorry. and we backed off a lot from comparing to the incumbent, because I think there are a lot of similarities to Electron, to Capacitor, etc. But there's also a nuanced difference. And one of those nuanced differences is that when you ship your Electron app, you're shipping all of your JS code in plain text. It's packed as an ASR, but there's an ASR decompile that will reconstruct the entire folder structure of your application. Because Tau recompiles, it's not easy to reverse. Of course, you can reverse things and find secrets inside, but not being able to reverse the code to reconstruct and copy and clone a project is a huge advantage. I think another advantage is that you're not just limited to JavaScript, TypeScript, WASM on the user interface and JavaScript on the back end. The number of native languages that you can compile down to binaries and ship them with Tau apps and interact with them is limitless. We've seen a lot of people do this with Python, with Elixir. People are working on this with PHP. There's also JavaScript that you can embed. You can just PKG up a Node.js script and interact with it. And that's also a benefit. I think, the size does matter. Obviously, that's the elephant in the room. When you do your job right and you care about binary size, Tau apps are, hitting 6 to 8 megabytes on average. And, Electron is 150, 200 megabytes. And I think, this might drift a little bit into the philosophical. I think that we don't agree that it's all free real estate. Just because you've got 64 gigabytes of RAM in your MacBook Pro M3 doesn't mean that applications should be consuming everything they can get their hands on. Now, I know operating systems don't work that way, but still, when you're shipping an application that has a million users, you're shipping an app with a million downloads, and you're shipping that app on a weekly cadence with updates, that creates terabytes and terabytes and ultimately petabytes of traffic over a year that you don't need. And for me, finding this like panacea of, well, we get to use Rust, so we've got all the memory guarantees that Rust brings. That means that our binaries are smaller. And furthermore, we've got less surface area for attackers to, dig into. Gadget attacks are always going to be possible, but, there's less surface area to put stuff together on. And all of that leads to a way of thinking that smaller is better, less is more, and security is something that you don't have to ignore because you don't have time for it. We help people build secure first and design things local first. And I think that would be my last comment about, general purpose application development that Electron, in my mind, represents. We try to offer people who are developers or becoming developers the opportunity to learn about what it means to do the thing that they're doing, right? That philosophical side of being a software engineer and shipping code to people who are going to use it is something we give people the opportunity to think about. And maybe they don't all need to, but being put in a position really helps them.
There's a lot to unpack there, a lot of really good stuff. So one of the things I wanted to mention, so you talked about like running other languages. My understanding is like there's two sides to a Tau app, like there would be two sides to an Electron app. You have your client renderer, which can be a web view in your case, which would be Chromium, like a Chromium renderer on an Electron. And then you have the back half, which is some application. So you talked about like having Rust as sort of your native default framework and language. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about that, but you talked about supporting other languages. And my understanding is this is from the sidecar feature. So you can have any binary can be just like registered as a sidecar that can be that the Tau app can talk to. And
yep.
Is that correct? Cool. That's a really awesome feature. I actually really love that one, just because it does make it kind of simple to think about like deployment and I can talk to any systems engineer about a binary, right? Like that's something people we have a long history of interacting with these things, understanding the communication models, the security models, everything like that. So that's pretty cool. I do want to ask one question. Why Rust? Why Rust as the language that the application layer is built on?
Well, the first Tau POC was actually written in C because we were using this binding from Zsearch. That was the first binding we had contact with. And the next one was in Go, but we decided to go with Rust mainly because of the memory features that it has. So memory safety is really important to us, and that's why we chose Rust, even though it was really a challenge because Rust is kind of complicated to learn, and the compiler got me like most of my nights when we were starting.
I think Justin can resonate with that one.
Oh, yes. Oxide is all Rust all the time, so I feel you.
Once again, we'd like to thank Raycast. Without our sponsors, this podcast wouldn't be possible. Raycast is an app for Mac that's like Spotlight, but with superpowers. It puts Alfred and all the competitors in the dust. It has a bunch of really cool features that they ship with it, and the community has made a bunch of extensions that extend Raycast to be even more powerful. Raycast is great because it can replace so many different tools on your Mac. Personally, I've been using the clipboard history every single day since I discovered it, and it's completely changed how I use my computer. Some other features that I recently learned about is Raycast can completely manage all of the windows and spaces on your Mac. So you can get rid of all those other random apps that you've downloaded to do this one specific task. Raycast can do it all for you. And that's not all they have. With Raycast Pro, you can access Raycast AI, where the world really opens up and you get AI at your fingertips. Raycast Pro also comes with Raycast Teams, so you can share all the cool workflows that you made that are company specific. Do you want to learn more about Raycast? Head over to episode 38, where we talk to the CEO, Thomas, about where the product started and where it's going to go. Do you want to advertise with DevTools FM? Head over to devtools.fm/sponsor to apply. Do you want to not hear these ads anymore? Well, we got a solution for you. You can become a paid subscriber on a bunch of different platforms, and then you'll get the episodes ad-free, and you'll never have to hear this part of the episode again. And last but not least, head over to our merch shop, where you can pick up cool things like this beanie that I'm wearing right now. With that, let's get back to the episode. Yeah, so Daniel, you said something interesting about a bundle size to me. Like the cost that we pay for bundle sizes, we usually just like, oh, it takes a longer time to download, but just like the angle of like, that those downloads cost something. They cost the planet something. They cost the people something. So like getting those lower is like, I think there's a lot of stuff in software right now that has a lot of optimization that can happen. And just bundle sizes being smaller is one thing that is, it could help the planet, in my opinion.
It can, but when was the last time you traveled to Switzerland?
Never.
All right. So I live in Europe and I travel around a lot. My daughter lives in Germany. My friends live in Holland, and there's conferences all over the place. And if I can, I take a train. If I can't, I fly. If it's possible, I'll take the slow ferry. But in Europe, you have a guaranteed price that you pay for mobile traffic. It's the same if you're in Malta as it is in Germany or France or Spain, etc. If it's part of the EU, then it's all kind of normalized. And I don't know why, but somehow my phone always realizes when I'm in the airport in Switzerland, because, you know, it switches over to Swiss. I get a message on my phone that says every megabyte costs 1 cent. No, it's 10 cents. Excuse me. Every megabyte. I have the screenshot, but like you start to think like, why does LinkedIn app on my phone weigh, I don't know, like 250 megabytes? Like, really? So I'm going to pay, I did work it out. It's like, I paid 20 euro because I'm in Switzerland and my app wants to update, right? And I go to Turkey. It's the same thing that's happened to me there, but I'm sure if you're traveling in Europe and you're not on a hotel Wi-Fi or a coffee shop Wi-Fi and you suddenly update, that's going to actually cost you money. And I'm not getting into the politics of the pricing of IP transit, because we know that's a whole nother ball of wax. But still, like, for people who are digital nomads who travel a lot, this kind of binary that's 5 megabytes, okay, it costs you 50 cents. All right, I can kind of live with that, right? And so if you start thinking about money and the monetary impact that it has, well, it's a relevant concern in some cases. And yeah, I don't know. That's just my like reaction to, oh, well, if you tweet a message and 10 million people see it, you just caused more traffic than downloading your 150 megabyte app. I get it. But the counter argument is we can do better. We can find solutions that are actually good for the planet. Like, just because it doesn't save everything, saving a little bit's a good first step.
Yeah, I work at Descript and we have a very large Electron app. And I was just so surprised to find out that when we release a new version, it costs us like $2,000 every time just for people to download our app, which is just like mind blowing. So there's lots of money that can be saved everywhere. But that the bundle size that we're talking about here, like the browser, that code does do things. So like, let's say you have a web browser on your Switch. A lot of people might have experienced this where they try to browse the web and then they get to a video and then the video doesn't play. And that's because while they can use a web view, web views aren't browsers and don't have all of the technology that's like bundled into browsers. So is that like the same of building a Tori app? So like if I had video needs, would I need to be like, oh, I need to start thinking about what video things to bundle into my Tori app to make all of that work?
Well, I mean, if you need to use FFmpeg to, you know, transcode something, then you probably need to bundle FFmpeg, right? But yeah. Generally speaking, on all three platforms, video works fine. Okay. I think on Windows, it's Edge-based. The WebView 2 is Edge-based. On Mac, the WK WebView is Safari-based. And currently on Linux, we're using WebKit GTK. And I believe that uses GStreamer under the hood. So video is fine. I think we are running into some rough edges on Linux particularly. But I would, there's one benefit that Tauri has that most websites don't have, or two benefits that I can think of out of the gate. One is that your local storage, your cookies, your IndexedDB is not going to be pruned. Ever. If you're using the Tauri way to store data inside of the app data folder, it's never going to be pruned. If your system runs out of space, your system runs out of space. But if there's only 25% system space left, you have no guarantee in the browser anymore that the data you think is there is still there. So you constantly have to refresh it, right? Like, I think it's 2 weeks right now is all that Safari is guaranteeing. And the other thing that I think is also quite interesting is that if you look at the way that single page apps have developed, you kind of imagine that people are always routing to a thing, they're single tasking. And with Tauri, it's relatively trivial to have two windows, right? I mean, I'm not sure how many monitors you have, but there's one on my computer and then there's one right there. And, you know, you can multitask with Tauri apps. I mean, video applications are a perfect example of that.
Maybe moving on from the technical a little bit, something that I found really surprising about Tauri is that y'all have a rather robust governance structure for what I see as, you know, a relatively young project. I know you aren't super young, but it's relatively young in my mind. And when I think about like projects like, say, Node.js, for example, which went through a lot of transitions from being stewarded by an individual company to like having that break out and become a foundation and all that stuff, it's like usually it takes a long time in the life of a project to develop such a robust governance structure. And I was just curious why you felt necessary to set that up and how that came about. And how it's working out for you so far?
You know, I think we consciously took an iterative approach to governance. What I mean by that is we knew day one that crazy governance and working groups isn't going to be possible because it was just two of us. And then it became five of us, but everybody was still coding. And multiple groups, there's only one group, there's core, right? So we started out with core. And I think one of the first wake-up calls we got was when a venture capitalist cold emailed us. And that was the trigger for phase two of our organization, which was to place the moral stewardship of Tauri within the structure of the Commons Conservancy, which is a Dutch foundation that exists. It doesn't have money. It doesn't transfer money. There's zero cash involved, but it does exist to provide a legal framework for a software community to elect board members and also de-elect them should they do something wrong. And I think that, you know, that type of governance was there not because we expected somebody to flip and try to sell stuff, but just to take that play off the table, right? Like, Tauri is and always will be an open source project licensed under MIT Apache 2 because there is a foundation behind it making sure that that happens. Should somebody of us decide to, you know, abuse our administrator rights to the code and then change all the licenses? Well, I mean, first of all, we have checks and balances in place, right? Like, no one person can commit the code without resetting the branch protections, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, you have to have someone else sign off on it. And in that case, it would be a coup d'etat. And if there's a coup d'etat, the community could rise up, evict the board members, or challenge the board members to set things right. And, that was a lot. I think we were lucky to have 7 people who decided they were going to be part of that. And spinning up governance isn't easy because you always anticipate the lowest common denominator of someone hating what you're doing and trying to, you know, poke holes in your own idea. You know, so we were constantly playing devil's advocate with ourselves. And what that led to also was a bit of stagnation in the group. And that's when we evolved again. We created, we kept the working group as it was. Anyone can join, et cetera. But we provided a new type, or maybe not type, maybe topology, where we have, several different groups in our organization now who are members of what we call a domain. So there's the community domain, which deals with like the Discord, the Twitter, the websites, the documentation, right? The kind of outreach group. And then we have an ops domain. And I mean, we don't have a lot of ops because, the Tauri group is running its website on Netlify, but, you know, there's still a couple other services and there's stuff like email that you got to manage. So we have an ops team. And then we've got the engineering group. And we thought about adding a security group, but decided it wasn't absolutely essential because security is a super group. It reaches everywhere. It touches everything. It knows everything. It maybe knows more than some people. And there's no need to make an additional working group section just for them, you know? And, you know, that's kind of where we are now. I think, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later, the next step is probably the collaboration with Crab Nebula.
I still find this, just hearing you talk about this, it almost sounds like even from the very beginning, you were thinking about governance, which maybe I'm not, I don't really have a sample size of this, right? So I can only go off my intuition, but I feel like most open source projects don't start thinking, like, even in the beginning, is like, oh, should we think about governance or talk about governance? There are common things like, you know, having a code of conduct, you know, wanting to have some rules around the community that are contributing. And usually those things come like post it being one or two people working on it. And they're like, okay, you know, something happened, or we want to head off something happening. Let's like do a little bit more. But you've come really far down this path, and I find it quite striking. But I hope that this comes off well. I find it really congruent with the image that y'all put out of, because, you know, you've also thought a lot about security. You've thought a lot about performance. You've thought, there's like a lot of details that y'all have been incredibly, incredibly thoughtful about during the process, maybe preemptively, where, you know, if I look at a lot of other open source projects, until they get to a really large size, are not tackling these things in the same way. So I just think it's really interesting. And I do wonder, was that informed by past experience on other projects that like required this sort of thing?
When you work with a benevolent dictator for life, it can be challenging to have your voice heard. It can be challenging to have transparency. But at the same time, I've done my 20,000 hours of community service, working in a variety of types of community groups, ranging from scrappy nonprofits to foundations. And one of the things that I always come back to in volunteerism, because open source is about volunteers. It's really about finding a way for you to make a difference in a world that you care about. And the learning that I gained from all of that time in these various entities was the best way to encourage people to stick around is to make them accountable to each other, make them care about each other and how the others are doing and aware of what's going on. And what that does is it automatically breaks down silos and it creates bonds that, I mean, that you can actually achieve in the digital world. I think, Lucas, how long was it until we met each other in the real world? Like 4 years?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Another common theme on the podcast is how open source can connect us. Like Justin and I are a great example. We actually met through open source in a same situation. Didn't know each other for years in real life. So you touched on this a little bit, but Tori seems to be like really focus on security. Like, as you said, it's like a super group across everybody. You've gone through a few different security audits. So, can you tell us about like what those entailed and like some of the things that Tori does to make sure that your app is secure?
Yeah, we think about security a lot. So that's why every major release is audited. We had external audits for everyone from externally. What's the name?
Radically Open Security.
And also every minor release is also audited by the Crab Nebula security team. We think that's really important. So far, we've only had minor issues after the stable release, so that's good. That's why we have these audits.
What are some of like the crazier things that Tori does to like do security? Like I see like you guys mentioned in the docs, there's like no server. There's a bunch of things you do with functions.
So you mentioned there's no server, correct? There is no local host server, which means there's no port, there's no loopback, there's no 127.0.0.1 because we architected it differently. Yes, you can use a web stack in the front, but ultimately you send a request over a custom protocol and you receive the response over that custom protocol. It's kind of like if you ripped out the TCP stack of a server. And we're just like talking straight to it. Like, you know, that's kind of a way to understand what's going on there. So that's the server. Maybe Lucas, you've got a couple other things up your sleeve, like the isolation pattern.
Yeah, we also have had this pattern that we built because of the V1 security audit. So basically to secure all the communication between the front end and the Rust side, we use an iframe to intercept all the calls and let the user check if the messages are valid and see if there's an outsider trying to use the backend.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. One thing that seems like I've done a lot of Electron dev at this point, that's a pain to do is communicate between the main process and the renderer process. Does Tori provide an easy way to do that? And then I also saw that on your roadmap, you have a thing like called message channels coming out. So does that kind of relate also?
Yeah, we have IPC, which stands for Internal Process Communication Layer, that is exposed by the web view. And on V2, it's also going to be a lot faster. Basically, it uses kind of like a localhost server, but not really a localhost because it's provided by the web view. So it basically, it works like an actor system. So you pass a message from the front end to the back end and you get a response back. And on the back end, you can find some functions that can be used by the front end. Those functions are called commands, and I think it's a lot easier to define those than Electron because we also have the Rust powers of macros and all that kind of stuff. So you can check for input arguments and have some dependencies injected. So it's easier to implement that kind of stuff.
I mean, that is maybe one of the interesting parts about the nuance, I guess, between Tauri and Electron, in that you're not executing JavaScript on the back end, right? You're passing messages. And what we've done for the entire surface area of the Tauri API is we provide JavaScript for that. So you can just use some syntactic sugar, basically, and send a message across the boundary from the web view to the Rust core, have it interpreted there, and then, like Lucas was saying, the response is sent back across a similar channel as basically an object. But there's no function passing, right? So that in and of itself is another elegant security boundary that kind of happened. You know, it was like, oh nice.
I'm reminded, I think I've told this story before on the podcast. So my first foray into any Electron app was actually contributing to the Atom editor from GitHub, which is like kind of what Electron was built for. And one of the things that I did was I added a GitHub notifications extension. So it's like, I just want a little icon to show me like when I have new GitHub notifications. And then I was like, okay, well, I need to get my personal access token and stick it in here. And I was like, how do I like not let everything else read this? And then I like couldn't find it in the docs. I couldn't really figure it out. And I like asked the question and issue. And they're like, there is no, I was like, what is the security model? Like, how do I isolate this from other things? It's like, you don't. Like everything, it's like very permissive. And, you know, it's funny, it's like something that for a long time has been true, both in Electron and Node, is that it's completely expressive and completely permissive. Like you get access to everything all the time. Granted, new versions of Node, they have some security levers that you can pull for, but I don't think that those are really well known yet. So I guess when I was looking into Tauri, that was like a thing that was very striking to me. It reminds me in like no small way of like this relationship of like Dino doing a very similar thing where it has this like message passing channel that for things like when you try to do an FS call in Dino, like you write some JavaScript, it's not like sending an SF thing to V8. It's like sending a message through this channel that, you know, lower level Rust code can check. It's like, do you have permissions to do this? And if you do, then it will do the FS call itself. So it's like an abstraction of, similar to what you might do on the web. So I love this model though, or this new future of like giving us more expanding permissions, capabilities, and security features, because honestly, I feel like open source in particular in like several, like the application frameworks and the web frameworks and stuff that we've done in the last few years, is like security has not always been top of mind. You know, people try, but it's like, you know, sometimes it's like a non-starter, and I don't know, definitely a need for this, I think, in the ecosystem. So
there's a huge mythology about open source software though. And that is, if you make it open source, somebody somewhere is going to read your code and find your security vulnerabilities and make a patch and make a pull request and inform you about it, you know, in an elegant way, definitely not on Twitter. But that, like, I really haven't seen that happen so much. Like, sure, some people will disclose over Discord accidentally, not realizing that it's actually a vulnerability, you know? But I think that designing from the perspective of security first does have its downsides. You know, one of our clients at Crab Nebula recently told me, yeah, Daniel, you know, we don't need a security audit because you guys did such a great job building a secure platform. And I'm like, okay, the messaging has to improve somehow, because yeah, sure we did, but humans make mistakes.
Yeah, you can build a good foundation to a house, but if the window's open, like, they're still going to get in.
Exactly.
We've talked about the features that we think are interesting so far, but are there some features that you guys think are interesting that we haven't called out yet?
Well, on top of this IPC message system that we built, we also have the allow list, which on V1 is basically a configuration that you can use to set what kind of APIs you want your front end to have access. So if you don't need to access the file system, you can just block that and not be vulnerable to that attack vector. And on V2, we are expanding that work, so it's even more configurable for different URLs and different windows. So it would be a lot better for for setting up permissions on different use cases?
I think one of mine is the updater. One of the success criteria for the V1.0 was that we have an updater, right? I think a lot of frameworks that want people to build apps forget about that. Like they forget about organization, like they forget about security. They're like, yeah, you can do our thing. You can do something awesome with this new tech and it's so great. But they forget about the fact that if you put an application into the world, at some point you're going to have to update it. And if you expect people to download it again and then install it in the right place, I mean, things can go horribly wrong. And on Windows, they do sometimes if you're using Electron or other systems. And what we ended up building for Towery was a bundler and an updater that also uses an additional developer key, a Towery key, so that the app knows that the update is from the same developer. Again, like experience in the real world of building and shipping apps is, I think, something that's come back to us over and over again as a fruitful kind of opportunity. And I love that piece, and maybe we'll talk a little bit later about it as well.
Yeah. Well, having worked on an Electron app a lot, like literally our number one complaint is like that update button is in my app too much. So like the one that you guys have integrated into Towery, is it does it like do background updates or like what's the type of API that it provides that?
Yes. You don't really need the user interaction to update. It just pulls the backend for a JSON file to see what's the latest version, and you can download the new app on the background and just install it automatically, and the user don't even need to worry about that.
So does the app really just like kind of act as a shell, or like are there some types of updates where I would actually need to like ship a whole new thing?
It's actually the entire app. That is big, but the app itself is quite small, so it's super fast.
There's a lot of complexity in the actual topology of this. For example, today we were solving a long-standing issue about multi-tenancy systems such as a Windows server, where every user is expected to use a Towery app. However, up until an hour ago or so, there was only one installation, which means that if you weren't the owner of that installation, then you couldn't update. Maybe in some cases it would segfault. And now, because we got feedback from the community, we recognized, oh yeah, right. So now on multi-tenancy Windows systems, the application will be installed once per user. And then each user has to update, and defining the update strategy is really up to the engineering team. I mean, there are use cases where you absolutely do not want the user to be updating their system in the background. If you've got some kind of long running task, like a video render, right? Like that's how you get people to walk away, right? If you crash their system because you needed to update. So I think that we've tried to design it in a way that is configurable, you know?
Something I haven't thought about. So you have to, I guess you have to be concerned with the sidecar process too during update. So does the updater like have, is there some facility for helping you do that?
Well, since you actually need to bundle the sidecar together with your application, gotcha, you are going to update the entire package no matter what.
Gotcha, that makes sense.
That's how we work right now.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about Towery and some of the features and functionality and project setup. Something else that I think, you know, would be great for us to talk about is this company that you formed alongside Towery called Crab Nebula. What is Crab Nebula and what is your relationship with the company and how does it relate to Towery?
Because I was talking earlier about the growth of an ecosystem. And one of the things that you will, if you don't experience it personally, you might hear stories about it, is that people burn out in open source software. A lot of groups encourage people to work in their free time, after work, at the weekends, on the holidays. Avoid your family between Christmas and New Year's and code up some stuff, right? And when you realize that people are actually using your framework, they're making a livelihood on the success of this framework, it turns you on even stronger, right? And we have lost a few people to burnout at Towery, and we saw it coming again. We knew that it was going to be important to create a business strategy around the holes that open source leaves. And in so doing, sustain the maintainers so that they're not working altogether 70 hours a week, right? And one of the things that you have to realize about open source is that, again, coming back to the notion of volunteerism, as a leader in an open source community, you cannot force a volunteer to do work on a specific schedule. First of all, it just doesn't work. Second of all, it's probably morally reprehensible. And thirdly, that's how you really burn people out, right? Well, and fourthly, who writes the invoice? You know, because there's also things like sales tax, you know? And then you get into other sticky situations where people come to the Discord and they ask a question about something ultra complex. And they're like, yeah, the code's proprietary. Can't show you. You can make a rep row, but it's not the same. And at that point, as an open source contributor, or you know, maybe you're the Discord solutions expert because you love telling people how to fix things, you start to feel like you're being taken advantage of, which might not be the case intentionally. But if you do this for enough years, you kind of start to see the pattern again. And furthermore, who signs the NDA? Right? Like, if Fabian Lars signs the NDA, does Lucas have to sign the NDA too before they can? The nonprofit, the foundation isn't going to sign an NDA. Like, NDAs exist as a license to sue. That's all they're there for. And the foundation wants nothing to do with that. So we carved out a niche of problems that people were continuously facing and kind of got a twofer. Maybe Lucas, you'd like to talk more about how we actually set up the company.
Yeah, sure. Basically, all the biggest Tower contributors are Crab Nebula employees. So that's one of the first goals of the company. As Dana said, we wanted to support everyone and not leave Tower by itself, because previously, everyone had their own jobs, and we had to work on Tari during our evenings. I had to do that for at least three, maybe four years. And it's a lot to have to deal with. And you will end up getting a burnout. It's inevitable, I think.
So how many people do you guys have working on like Tori and Crab Nebula full-time now?
The company has 28 full-time employees. I would say split down like thirds. So one third is focused on research, development, and maintenance, RDM, which is there so that anybody who has an amazing idea can take some time to flesh it out. And then we would move it into development after the middle tier of product and finance decides that it's something that we want to productify. And then, you know, the actual engineering teams, you know, building out the products, doing the DevRel, communicating, documenting, that kind of thing.
It's a good amount of people.
It's the right amount. It was the right amount. I think that we would never have finished Towery 2.0 at this pace alongside mobile, without that team being focused like that's their life energy. That's what they're that's what they get to do, you know. And without product, you know, how do you keep a timeline together? Right? And without DevRel, how do you communicate about it? And without engineers building stuff, how do you do that? And because of the fact that we have extraordinarily talented engineers in the research, development, and maintenance team, when one of the other departments needs help, it's easy for them to just jump in, check out the ticket, figure it out, solve it, and then move on. So we have these kind of flexible team sizes that range from 3 to 10, depending on, you know, what's urgent or where extra special support is needed.
So when y'all created the company, was it initially just mostly consulting? Is that was like, we will help you solve problems with Tori? Or what was the sort of goal of the company at first?
We knew that we needed about a year to get the first products up. And if you just burn investor money without taking in a little bit, you're missing two opportunities. One opportunity that you're missing is the success of shipping something. Like when a client hires you to do something and you're able to do it and they say, thank you, that's exactly what we needed. And you did it on ahead of time. Wow. Like that's a great feeling that keeps people motivated. And it also keeps us close to the community because we really only take clients from the Towery community. And we prefer to do work that's going to go back into the open source community. Right? Like if you find a ticket that's been languishing for 2 years and you think it's really important, more important than we thought, because we're working on other stuff that's more core, but you could pick it up and come to us and say, hey, how long would it take you to actually do this? Right. And, you know, because we have the entire core team of Towery engineers, including Lucas and Amr and Yuwei and Fabian Lars, and I'm not going to give the entire list, but because they all work at Crab Nebula, we know that our velocity is a 5 to 10 times faster than anybody who's just picking it up or even who's been working with it for a year. So those are the benefits. And, you know, from clients who've been with us for, you know, the past 6-9 months, all of them are super excited about testing out our new products when we bring them out. And they're the ones who are going to be getting the friends and family access, right? They're the ones who are... We've developed a type of communication with them where we're always honest with each other and we tell each other what's going on and what works and what doesn't. And that kind of early focus group is great when you have the anticipation of product market fit, but you're still looking for those actual details to prove it, right? So it in a sense, it was really important for the first year, but in year two of Crab Nebula, which we're in, by the way, we're going to be very, very selective about the client work that we take on because the products are now coming onto the market and they need our attention. Of course, if my friend Dave Tier is listening and 1Password decides they want to pull the trigger and move to Towery, you better believe we would be teaming up and growing the team and making that happen, right? So I think... It was an important step in the first year of the organization, and it does a lot of other things too. Like it makes sure that we have healthy finance. We have a healthy finance team, right? We can write invoices. And then it sounds funny to say, but when you have a global company that deals with compliance issues in, well, right now, how many, 13 countries? Because that's where we have employees. Then, you know, it's something that we're not going to have to look at when we launch the SaaS, right? Like, oh, geez, we need to have credit card. Oh, how do we do that? You know, we've already solved these boring problems, but as part of the tactical approach to building a company that wants to be more than a startup, right? Do you know what I mean by that? Like if all of your energy goes into being a great startup, you're going to burn out. Your people are going to be working 60, 70 hours a week. They're going to start hating each other. People are going to be short with each other and screaming because stuff didn't ship on time. And at Crab Nebula, we're very proud of having a 4-day work week. We do that because We believe that work expands to fill the time that you give it. And the longer you let me talk, the more I'm going to talk. And it's the same thing with work, right? The fewer meetings that we have, the more time we get to stuff done. And you're not pushing stuff off till Friday because you have to do it when Thursday. But actually, release day is Tuesday, always. It's always going to be Tuesday because Monday you can check everything, make sure it's working out. Tuesday you have your release day. Wednesday, Thursday, you got time to fix stuff. And then, you know, it's just ops there at the weekend, right? And I think that giving people the opportunity to recover their energy means they get back on Monday and they're like really excited to be back at work. I know it happens to me, and yes, that's something a CEO would say. Maybe we should take a poll.
All good, all good. So you mentioned some products that you're working on, and one of the ones that you've announced is the DevTools for Atari. So could you give us a little brief intro to like what the DevTools will be like and what your plans for it are?
Yeah, I can take that one. So most of the Atari users are web developers, and if you are a web developer, you'll know the browser inspector or the browser DevTools, which is that little window that has the console, network, services, that kind of stuff. But when you are building a native application, you don't really have that kind of information for your app itself. So we wanted to build that. And this new app that we built is shipped as a Atari plugin that starts a server, starts a WebSocket server on your application that can be accessed by the front end on your browser. And we basically use the tracing crate, which is a crate that most huge library authors are using to send logs and tracing metadata to the application writers. And we get all that information and show on the front end. So basically we have the console, which shows all the logs from your application itself. We have a network-like type that, which is showing all the blocks of code your app has and how much time IPC message passing is taking, that kind of stuff. And we also have a view to show all the services that your application has embedded. So you can you can check why your app is crashing or what's going on and why some IPC call is taking so much time, that kind of stuff.
That's cool, but it begs the question in me, like, so we're using web views. Do we have access to like browser dev tools?
Yes, but that's only for the front end itself, not for the shell or the Rust side.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I definitely have nothing like that in Electron land. I just get to look at a whole bunch of logs spewed to my terminal. So any structure is better. So that seems like a cool new product, but you also mentioned that you this year completed Tori 2.0. I didn't see that had been released yet. So like, what are some cool features that you guys built along with that?
We are still in alpha. We are actually going through an audit right now. The low-level grades are being audited, and we are going to start the Tori audit when the final feature gets released, which is the new analyst. So basically, the V2 has a bunch of new features that the community has been requesting a lot, like context menus and JavaScript APIs for tray and window menus and all the kind of stuff, plus deep links, file associations, new APIs for window personalization, that kind of stuff. But the big new feature is the mobile platform targets. It will basically be just like the desktop. It will also leverage the system web view on Android and iOS. And we try to be as compatible as possible. So your app, your existing Tori app will just be able to be compiled for mobile, and it should simply work. Of course, there are some APIs that simply do not exist on mobile, like the CLI, but we try to be as compatible as possible. So it's just like dropping and you get a mobile app out of your existing app. And we also invested a lot of time on developer experience. So you don't really have to open Xcode or Android Studio or waste your system resources on that. We will bundle the application for you. We start the platform simulator and for you, and also run on the existing devices if you do want to do that.
That mobile feature seems super cool. Like Daniel mentioned PhoneGap or Cordova earlier, and it kind of feels like it's come full circle that like you can now deploy to mobile too.
You know, there were some voices in the Telrik community who felt like it was a distraction to build mobile, that we would have been better served focusing on, achieving parity with all of the Electron things or building a new web view or, you know, that kind of stuff. And at the beginning, you know, when that specific issue was raised, I didn't have a great answer for it. But today, looking back, not in hindsight, but in retrospect, what I can confidently say is that the architectural modifications required of us to build mobile have actually fed back into the desktop system itself and made desktop more robust. And that, from my perspective, is a win. Is it going to be as good as Capacitor? I don't like those kind of conversations because we're no longer battling the incumbents. I think that Tauri, after 5 years, has shown that it is not only capable of adapting and growing, but also resolving issues that people find. So it's a resilient ecosystem that is here to stay. And at some point, Capacitor and Electron are going to start comparing notes with what we're doing and learn from that. And I hope that that's the case. If it's not, what I can tell you is that at Crab Nebula, we spent some time at the beginning thinking we were just going to be the Telri company. And we realized as time went on, especially in the context of 2.0, the notion of what a Telri app is changing. That idea, Telri app, it means it's a web view and it's using the Telri core project and you can use JavaScript. And that's changing. Today, people are using our low-level libraries. I mean, just recently, our friends over at Fig.io got acquired by AWS, and they were building on top of Telri's deep tech, Hao and Rai. And other projects like, Dioxys, is just to name one, is also using that low-level system, but yet we couldn't support them with our bundler and updater that I mentioned earlier. Like, such an important part of what made Telri successful is that whole ecosystem play of being able to ship your updates, right? But we couldn't help our friends at Dioxys. So we literally upstreamed Tauri's bundler and updater. We created a new project at Crab Nebula. It's again, open source, Apache 2 MIT. It's called Cargo Packager. And we did it in a way that not only can people from the Rust ecosystem profit from it, you can use it as a library. You can use it as a crate. You can build a CLI with it. If you can build a CLI with it, you can also package up Electron apps. You can package up, anything that's a binary that needs to be signed and get icons and all that good stuff can be managed with this packager system that we built, because we want the ecosystem to come together.
That's all super exciting to me.
Yeah, I think, again, I just want to reemphasize, I appreciate the care of the whole process of like designing Tauri, of like setting up the company, of doing the governance, of thinking about security. Like, all of these things are layer and layer and layer, even like pulling out the updater to be more of a general use thing. I think that, you know, the project, just from how you approach building it, is very special. And there is a huge need for tools in the open source space to be able to build more secure, more performant, smaller, apps, like whether it's desktop or mobile, which like it's really hard to just say, oh yeah, I'm only going to ship a desktop app these days, given that like a lot of computing is done on mobile. So like from that perspective, I think the business decision of like having Toria support makes a lot of sense. And you know, we have solutions out there for doing things, and you know, oftentimes we always have to make trade-offs, and Toria is going to have to make trade-offs too. But yeah, I think the trade-offs that y'all have made are pretty special. So it's definitely cool to see it develop for sure. I'm very excited for 2.0 because I want to use it. So before we wrap, we usually always ask a forward-facing question, and we're trying to figure out like what a good forward-facing question for y'all would be. Maybe one would be, what is your vision of the future of building cross-platform apps look like, and how does Tari play into that vision for either of you?
I don't know. I've built some apps in the past, and I always had to use two separate tools, one for desktop and one for mobile. And I think with Tari V2, that will change. I think you just need to use a single front end and Rust code base to ship to both platforms. I think that would be nice. So you don't have to have an Electron application and a separate capacitor application for all that.
You know, the week that Tauri 1.0 was announced last year was also the week that Internet Explorer and Atom shell were deprecated. Or that where their deprecation was announced. It wasn't planned like that. That those are just the two big news items from that literal week. And I like to keep that story in the back of my mind of how not listening to your users, not enabling developers to build cool stuff and to tell you what they think you should do better is a great way to end up in that graveyard of no longer relevant. I mean, we could argue that Safari is the new Internet Explorer, and some of my friends will tell you that's the case. But I think the larger point here is that Tauri as an organization is doing work not just for what it needs, but also for taking care of the ecosystem. Let me give you an example. You probably heard of Servo before, and Servo was this amazing research project from the Mozilla Foundation that was a Rust-based browser. Okay, and during COVID, the entire team was let go, which was sad. I think we were looking forward to someday using Servo as a web view target for Tauri. Maybe that day happens sometime next year. I don't know. But what I can tell you is that by building in a modular way, we've already built tools that other people are using, like Servo did. We're actually maintaining a couple of those crates from the former Servo project because we're using them and no one else was maintaining them. And someone has to do that. And I think that, or my hope is that the group of people who are getting involved with Tauri now, the youngsters that Lucas mentioned at the top of the call, are of the character to continue exploring what's possible and pushing the boundaries of patience by being maintainers and maintaining the code. For me, I think that's the mission we've set ourselves on. And I think that jumping forward 10 years, if there's still software engineers, there's definitely going to be people who need to think about what it means, what they're doing. And I hope that we can contribute to that.
Yeah, I'm rooting for you guys. I love the way that you are structuring it. And like, you're not just making one big executable, like just the fact that you like have like Rye, the web view rendering pack crate out there is just so awesome to see. And I hope the project is successful going forward, for sure.
Thanks.
So that wraps it up for the questions we have. Thanks for coming on, Lucas and Daniel. This is a super interesting conversation. I didn't think we'd go so far into like the company aspect of it and the community aspect of it, but what you guys have built there seems to be really cool. And I think you've set yourselves up for success.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, to echo what Andrew said, really glad to have y'all on. I've got to say, of the recent software projects that I've been following, and I'm just a huge fan, Tari and Dino are my number ones. It just so happens that there's some similar underlying elements in there, but like, I think, you know, I've said it a few times in this episode, but how y'all thought about security, how you thought about your, you know, how you set up the open source governance structure, how you think about like sustainability with building a company, all of that stuff, just like, you know, definitely screams this like very methodical intention. And so many times in open source, we lose out on that because things just sort of grow organically. There's not sustainable structures around there. And it can be harder to, you know, trust the project long-term or to like understand what you're going to get or whatever. So this conversation has just sort of increased my faith and you know, the Tari project over time. And, you know, I'm really excited to see where y'all go and what you build. I think it's going to be awesome. So it's great to have y'all on.
Looking forward to coming back.